A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Hello and welcome to the new edition of TLS Voices. My name is Stig Abel, editor of the Times Literary Supplement. I'm joined, as ever, by commissioning editor and the podcast's unchallenged pronunciation guru, Thea Lenarduzzi. Thea, last week, it is fair to say, I have genuinely been thinking of this more than once. You accused me of trying to be Blackadder to your Baldric. I love Blackadder, but I would never wish to make anyone a Baldric, and I'm going to resist the temptation to make any form of witless or...
reference to gout.
Gout. The pronunciation guru thing is just a fact. That's just your job. I don't think there's anything improper about referring to that. But
it doesn't say it on my staff card.
Does it not?
Should.
It should. Pronunciation. It should,
yeah. I could kind of freelance within the building.
I think being a guru of anything is a great thing. So we're going to move on. Before we get to the show, actually, I want to tell you how to get cheap subscriptions to the TLS. If you Google TLS subscriptions, click and type POD1, that's POD1 in the offer code tab, you can get 6 issues for just £6. So Google TLS subscriptions, type POD1 in the code and do that. Coming up on the show, we have a major piece by the wonderful novelist Emma McBride on the subject of bad sex writing and why it is not simply something squirmingly to laugh at. She'll be joining Thea and me to discuss that. Diana Dark has reviewed 2 books by women who have fled the traumas of the Middle East to seek solace in Europe. They are remarkable tales of survival, well worthy of all our consideration. And finally, Jenny Hendricks will join us to articulate the phenomenon of imaginative cartography, which is the artful cousin of that, dare I say, slightly tiresome genre of psychogeography. She'll be on the line from New York. Writing about sex, it is fair to say, can often be more fraught, more precarious than actually having it. The pitfalls are many, not least that of outright snorting amusement at attempts to describe an act that is open both to ridicule and to a sort of Laurentian over-seriousness. We had a piece on our website by Jonathan Gibbs last month that sought to articulate the case for good sex writing. In it, he memorably objected to a description of a man coming like a drinking horse on the grounds that it broke his law of the reversible simile. He said, if you can describe something as being like something else, then that comparison should work equally well in reverse. I'm yet to see a horse drink like a man coming, and I hope I never will. So laughing about this stuff is very right and proper. But here's the thing. Sexual expression is also closely connected to sexual politics, that ongoing, often dispiriting contest to ensure equality and fairness in how we talk about and consider gender and sex. How women are portrayed sexually in literature is important in the same way it is important how they are pictured and described in other forms of discourse too. Emma McBride, who it must be said writes beautifully and frankly about sex in her own novels, has reviewed a collection called Desire, edited by Mariella Frostrup, subtitled 100 of Literature's Sexiest Stories. It has to be said that many of these stories have left Emma cold, or worse, angry. She divided them into 3 categories, the good, the harmless, and the horrible. She joins Thea and me now to discuss them. Emma, you opened the review with the remark of a woman who said, I really like reading books about sex. Before we discuss this book, why do you think that's true? And is that a common thing?
Well, I mean, for me, it was a surprise when she said it to me. And I realised it was because I don't think I'd ever heard anyone, you know, speak about it. So frankly, before, it's usually something that's quite covert. It was something that I felt, you know, writing a lot as I do about sex myself, was something I wanted to explore a bit more, why we talk about it, why we write about it.
Because there's a distinction that you don't really get into too much because you don't think it's of that much interest between what's erotica and what's pornography. But do you think that it's covert in the sense that we're a bit embarrassed to read a book that majors on sex or a book that is designed, I suppose, to cause arousal in some way? Is that kind of an embarrassing thing?
Well, I think that there's a generational thing there. Certainly, you know, I'm 40 and I was certainly brought up in a generation where people would not sit and read a book like, you know, a pornographic novel like 50 Shades on the tube. And that has become something that's quite open now. You know, I think it's concerning that that is the kind of sex people feel comfortable with identifying themselves with in public.
Well, the 50 Shades is the kind of S&M stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, violent books about violent fantasy.
It's interesting that you, I don't know if this is interesting or not, but if I saw a man reading a pornographic book on the tube, I'd think it was creepier than if I saw a woman reading a pornographic book on the tube. Is that fair, do you think?
I think that is fair, but I equally think seeing a woman reading 50 Shades on the tube is concerning, and it's something that has this kind of fascination with female submissive fantasies has sort of sneaked in under the radar and become almost completely normalised.
I think also your discomfort, Stig, is probably to do... I mean, it's a clear... It shows how wrapped up the politics of power are with this question of force and strength and things like that.
Yeah.
Possibly. Anae Nin, who the editors named Chekima, she wrote that she had a feeling when she was composing this collection back in the 40s with other writers like Henry Miller. She wrote that she had a feeling that Pandora's Box contained the mysteries of women's sexuality, so different from a man's, and for which man's language was so inadequate. And the language of sex had yet to be invented, she thought. But she was convinced that the languages of male and female sexuality were distinct, which I find quite interesting. I mean, would you tend to agree with her, and does that work its way into this collection at all?
I think she is right, and I think, you know, as a writer myself writing about sex, one of the rules I set myself early on was that I wasn't allowed to use any of the traditional vocabulary, which seems very informed by the sex writing of male writers past rather than female writers. So I think she's absolutely right about that. It's also something that hasn't progressed very much, I think, over the years, and that's a shame. I think women are trapped into writing about sex in particular ways that are not necessarily always close to their own experience.
As I said, you split this book into sort of the good, the harmless and the horrible. The horrible is in some ways more important, but just to say, reading this, what makes good sex writing? What examples do you draw on? What do you think when you read it? Is it the freshness of the vocabulary and unwillingness to tread down the cliché of standard sex descriptions?
Yeah, I think it's about an approach to language, certainly, but also about a disregard for traditional roles or clichés. I mean, I think, for instance, Angela Carter's The Company of Wolves is a story about a woman finding sexuality and finding it in a dangerous place rather than a woman being destroyed by sexuality, by dangerous people. And there are so many other stories in this book that are about women being torn apart.
Well, let's that seems to be the critical bit that you get to, that this is a book which, although written, many of the contributions are written by women, it's edited by a woman in the form of Mariella Frostrup, and yet a large proportion of the stories find their sexual expression in violence towards women, and sometimes quite brutal violence towards women. And it made you angry, I think it's fair to say. I got that from the piece.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that's very alive in our culture at the moment. This, you know, complete focus on female submission fantasies, and I sort of air quote fantasies, because it seems to be something that's just endlessly thrust down our throat, and I'm concerned that younger women feel that this is in some way normal rather than particular to a certain genre. And my problem with this book was that there were so many stories about either that were about female submission, that weren't necessarily about violence, but as though most straight women, and the book is mostly about straight women, enjoy being sexually dominated. And this is, you know, this is not really questioned in any way. And then the much more concerning stories are the stories that are about, you know, these horrendous acts of violence that are actually quite hard to read, being portrayed as sexy. I mean, I object to these stories being in a collection called 100 Sexiest Stories.
Even if John Berger hadn't died recently, I'd be tempted to draw a connection between the collection and his distinction between naked, being naked and being a nude, in which it, to be naked is to get closer to knowing oneself and being oneself and being, you know, trying to discover some truth about oneself, which is what good sex writing does. And when you're in, if you're a nude, in which case you're performing, you're being consumed by someone else, generally a male gaze in Berger's analogy. It seems like something very, very similar is going on. So it's just the extent to which women have internalised the kind of the heteronormative fantasy, as you put it in inverted commas.
Well, you know, I think this is one of the big differences between good sex writing and the horrible sex writing, is that good sex writing places sexuality within a context, within a human context. And this kind of writing separates it out completely and turns the woman into an object, into a vacuum. And she's basically there to receive whatever is inflicted on her or inside her. And it doesn't actually make any human connection to what happens around all of those events, why that woman is in this situation, what happens to her afterwards, as though, you know, sort of terrible violence can be inflicted upon the body of a woman and then the next day she goes to the office as normal and everything's okay. In life, that isn't seen as all right. Why is that all right in fiction?
Well, and you quote, there's a woman who's punched in the vagina in one of these stories, and then the story concludes with her saying, "I love you, babe."
Yeah.
At the end is the example that you give. What about this notion, though, of freedom of expression, that these are, and this is, I think, from reading your review, Mariella Frostrup's position, that these are fantasies, these are acts of free expression, largely by women, it's edited by a woman, and they are entitled to write about violent sexual fantasies if they choose. Is there a free speech issue here? Are you saying this stuff should be published, but it shouldn't necessarily be published in a mainstream book that proclaims this as literature's sexiest stories?
Yeah, I mean, my argument isn't with the writers writing this material. I might find it unpalatable myself, but I don't have an objection to this being written or to it being published. I have a problem with it being collected all together in this anthology and called 100 Sexiest Stories. And it being so heavily weighted towards this kind of Sadian writing, sexual writing, rather than any other kind. You know, there are many other types of, you know, I mean, for instance, as a teenager, I remember reading, running down to the library in Castlebar and reading My Secret Garden by Nancy Friday, which was filled with female fantasies of all kinds. And when I agreed to review this book, I was sort of expecting something along those lines, but in terms of fiction. And instead, you know, I was just presented with these endless stories of female submission.
Who's reading this, Amy? Because that's the one question that I kind of struggle with by the end of this review. Because this is in some ways kind of posh literature. It's a relatively respectable imprint. It's done in a relatively glossy way. Is this stories for people to masturbate to but feel like they're clever at the same time? Is it stories for people to just place on their coffee table and show that they're pretty broad-minded? Is it aimed at men who want to get off on descriptions of women? Are women going to read this? I can't quite imagine who the ideal audience of this book is.
Well, you know, I think it's the remit of the book is completely fudged. There are lots of stories that are really just, you know, wanking stories, and they're sort of perfectly fine for serving that purpose, I suppose, but they don't have any literary merit. And then there are, you know, stories that are really about sexuality as well as about sex, and those are kind of the interesting ones and often quite beautiful. And stories collected from, or, you know, novels and things of historical relevance. And then all of this kind of other stuff, which is presumably aimed at fans of Fifty Shades and all those kind of S&M porn novels. So I don't really know. It's sort of enormous and flowery. I can't imagine who is supposed to read it.
I was equally intrigued, and I went onto Amazon because I wanted to see, you know, the reader reviews and wanted to see what they were like. And
yes,
you're absolutely true that, I mean, all of the comments, it's absolutely true what you said, Ema. They're all They're all comments left by women, and they're all 4 or 5 stars out of 5. Can I read you a couple of them? These were just extracts from them. Well written and tasty. A really enjoyable collection. Such fun. Like things like that. Actually, these two are my favourite. Bought this as a Christmas present for my husband, and he really loves it. Beautifully written. And then this is the best. Unusual book, well priced and delivered on time.
Well, you know, it has that in its favourite. Yeah, I mean, surprised, and I am not surprised.
Are we inured to this? I mean, is this in some ways that one of the pieces they make in the tradition? Oh, we have no power to be shocked anymore. But the quotes that you put in the review, I was slightly shocked by in moments. Certainly, I don't mind admitting. And your point, I think, at the end, you say you object to the future this book presents you with, your daughter with, everyone's daughters with, because effectively we're so inured to a certain type of worldview about men and women and women's submissiveness that maybe we're not shocked by it. And if Thea's reviews are indicative, then women have read this and gone, lovely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is quite a frightening phenomenon, because I don't think that people are inured, either men or women. And I think the assumption that we are, the assumption that women will be, just because some women will be, is quite dangerous. And I think that's why it was important to write, you know, to write about it the way I did, and as angrily as I did, because I think there are a lot of women who are really tired of being told that this is what women like and this is what women want, because it's not what I want. Mm. And I know lots of women, and they don't want it either, and they object to living in a society where this is considered normal, where this is something that's being peddled for people to, you know, give their husbands for Christmas, I suppose.
Well, I mean, I find some comfort in the thought that the society that called for and produced this book is also it's the same society that produced a writer who can write so concisely and insightfully against it, and, you know, modestly that there's a publication that publishes it as well. I think we have to take some comfort in that, because otherwise it's a thoroughly dispiriting exercise.
Oh, I think it's all a dispiriting exercise. But, you know, as long as we're not getting too tired to fight the fight, I think.
Yeah.
And you say at the end, just to finish with you, I just wish books about sex that would let me enjoy them weren't so hard to find. And that's probably true, isn't it? I mean, you could probably count the great books about sex on the fingers of one or two hands. I mean, and we had a review about 3 months ago or 4 months ago, maybe, about Henry Miller. Mm. Where Jim Campbell of our parish reappraised him and said, I couldn't believe how sort of cliched and sexist he was. And I remember reading Henry Miller at 18 and being really excited by it, because it was kind of transgressive. It was dark, but it was all, I felt at the time, it was also sort of challenging. And yet, I've picked up a copy of one of the books again recently, because I've got a lot of them, and it isn't. It's kind of trite, it's kind of embarrassing, and it's kind of a dirty old man writing about his fantasies. It's often in literature, I find, particularly modern literature, it's middle-aged men. Philip Roth did this, actually, in his last novel. You know, Philip Roth writing about lesbian sex, lesbian threesomes. And it's so often you get middle-aged men sort of recapturing their fantasies in prose. Do you think that's fair in the sense of how fiction deals with this? It's often that's the dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, I think it's really depressing that we have not come much further down the road with regard to sex writing than that. But, you know, looking at this book and looking at the kind of the historical writing they've included in it, there's not much after the 50s, really, that where anything interesting happened. And Henry Miller, you know, was important in his time because he broke the rules and he opened up writing about sex. But yeah, it's old-fashioned, misogynist, it's off its time, and it should be relegated to its time. But sadly, there's not much that's come along to take its place.
I think that's
and that's a shame.
That is a shame. Ema, it's such a great piece, and I really hope people read it, because at the end, I think you make a very, very strong case about why this is more troubling than just a naff book pushed out under the guise of sort of sexy literature. I think it is more important than that. So thank you so much for doing, and thank you for joining us now.
Thank you.
Yeah, the thing striking reading this, talking to Ema just then, is that there was some good writing. You talked about Anais Nin and Henry Miller, maybe Lawrence, maybe, although I find Lawrence silly. You like Lawrence more than I do. It doesn't feel that there's been great literature written recently, and actually there should be a time when we are becoming more progressive about sex, where we are more open about it, we are talking more freely about it. You know, even in fact a piece like this appearing in a paper like the TLS is kind of indicative of that potentially. Why are we not getting better quality writing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think, interestingly, when I try to think about books that I've read that have, you know, good sex in them, in inverted commas, I usually find myself thinking about books that have gay or lesbian sex in them, like The Swimming Pool Library or The Line of Beauty. Or I think a great example, actually, is Violette Leduc's book called Thérèse and Isabel. And it was censored when it was written, I think, in the 1950s, and it wasn't published until 2001 or something like that. And that's about two schoolgirls. And the reason that I think that my mind goes to those is because they're surprising to me.
Yeah.
Perhaps because they're not normative experiences, they're not experiences that I can relate to. I'm less likely to find cliche and sentimentality, and also because the writers know that they're writing for people for whom mostly this will be a foreign experience, the language is just so much more creative. And so when you think about Leduc, the poetry of that is astounding.
Yeah.
And the imagery is just pure creation.
And it'd be interesting if that approach were to be taken to something more familiar and more overworked, which is kind of heterosexual sex. The quote that Ema, so we might have to leave it here, says, how many of the stories have these cliches, tiny women being scared or awed, but eventually driven to unendurable ecstasies by big, hairy, dominant males, in combination with the thrillless tedium of wading through endless descriptions of heaving bosoms, damp sexes, hard nipples and aching erections are the literary equivalent of a cold shower. And I kind of think we've ended up this book, which doesn't need to exist, and yet it sort of manifested itself as not 100 of literature's sexiest stories, but just sort of a series of clichés captured between hard covers, and that's kind of a shame.
Yeah, sort of iterations on Stockholm Syndrome. Almost.
Yeah, the same thing over and over again.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Shall move on. We turn to the Middle East and the chance to hear from an expert in the area. Diana Dark has reviewed two books that tell the stories of women who have fled from war-torn Syria and Iraq in search of a new life in Europe. The first, The Girl Who Beat ISIS, is by Farida Khalaf in conjunction with the German journalist Andrea Hoffman. Farida lived in the Yazidi village of Kocho, south of Sinjar in the Nineveh Plains. In Kocho, people speak Kurdish, not Arabic, but retain friendly relations with Muslims. Indeed, each Yazidi male child has a Muslim godfather present at his circumcision. But that detente was shattered with the arrival of ISIS in the village, who massacred 80 men and enslaved the women. Thousands of women, actually. By enslaved, this means that Farida was sold at a slave market to a variety of owners for the purposes of rape. ISIS fighters combined their religious fervour with their bestial desires, praying before they forced themselves on girls, celebrating their rape as a form of worship, as one quote goes. In the second book, Nujeen Mustafa tells her story with the help of journalist Christina Lam. Nujeen has cerebral palsy, but her enforced physical immobility contrasted with her mental acuity and language skills. Her family moved from Kobani eventually to Aleppo, where Assad's goons forced them to flee to Manbij until the arrival of ISIS compelled them to move again. Nujeen then began a journey to Europe in her wheelchair. Diana joins Theo and me to discuss these books and the state of Syria more generally. Diana, were you shocked by Farida's story of the rape and the slavery, or is this so sadly commonplace to you now that it wasn't any more shocking than the other stories you've heard on the subject?
I'm afraid it's the latter, that although it is, of course, deeply shocking, it has become now so routine that this is the danger, actually, that because stories like this have become so routine that we become slightly inured to it. And that's almost worse than anything, that this level of sort of medieval bestiality, which is masquerading as Islam, is something that we're expected to except as, well, you know, I mean, the stories like this, they're just sort of rolling off our backs now as if this is just ordinary.
And does that go for the story of Nujeen as well? I mean, it seems to be at one level this extraordinary vision of her through presumably very difficult terrain, hugely difficult circumstances, her family fleeing to Europe with her in a wheelchair. That feels like an extraordinary act, or is that, again, maybe just one of the many extraordinary acts that take place in the life of refugees coming from that area?
Again, I think it is just one extraordinary act. The thing that struck me most about Nujeen's story, and which is a wonderful story about, you know, one of the strengths of that part of the world, is the sheer family cohesion. Yeah. The way that although she is, you know, an invalid, she's a burden, if you like, onto her family, but she is never made to feel that. She can't go anywhere except with their help. And yet she is this remarkably cheerful person, but she's totally supported by her family. There is never any sense of, oh, God, you know, what a nuisance you are, or anything like that. In fact, there's this wonderful constant banter with her. And, of course, the wonderful thing about her story is that she turns out to be the heroine because she's taught herself English by watching all these soaps on television. And then she is the sort of saviour when they arrive in Europe because she's the only one who can actually communicate with anybody.
And what are her prospects and that of her family? I mean, probably it's an interesting question for both of the two women. I mean, Nujeen has a brother in the UK, and there's a very sort of oddly poignant line where you say a fully trained dentist now making pizzas in Sheffield. Where, you know, people hugely qualified come to this country and often take jobs that aren't connected to their qualification. But what are their prospects and are they optimistic? Is this the both books end optimistically in that sense?
Well, we don't know, of course. I mean, they both make it to Germany, both girls. And of course, that in itself, you know, there's this big testimony, really, that the only way to get away, the only way to escape the ghastliness that's going on in their country is to leave. And we must never forget what a major decision that is. I mean, to leave everything behind. It's something we can't even begin to get close to. And for them, the integration into a society like Germany must be a colossal shock. And, of course, in the case of Farida, the Yazidi girl, she has to go alone. She doesn't go with her family. Nujeen is there in Germany with her family, supported by her family. But it's a very different story for the Yazidi girl. She, in a way, has to escape the shame of having been raped, that she can never be accepted in her own society because of this. At least in Germany, she won't have that stigma and she will get treatment. But even so, that the cultural integration of these people, it's going to take a long time. Of course, it's much easier for the younger generation. They, if they're still at school age, they will probably manage much, much better than the older generation.
Both of these books belong to a kind of publishing phenomenon, really. You refer to the Malala effect. And I suppose you have to wonder what pressures this places on the girls and on the young women and what happens after the press sort of dies down.
Well, this worries me deeply, actually, as an issue. The fact that there is an element where the stories of exceptional girls like this, you know, they can get caught up in a kind of media circus. And then their lives get sort of overtaken and they become this massive focus of attention for a short time. And then, of course, everybody's moved on to the next story. I mean, I get told stories from people who run charities, Syrian charities for refugees, how the media descends on them saying, oh, you know, we want to interview a young girl. She's got to be disabled. She's got to have only arrived here a month ago. And if they can't sort of miraculously produce a girl like that, they just rush off to the next place to see where they can find somebody who fits their narrative. And this is an aspect of our Western media that really bothers me, actually. It's cruel in its own way, this constant search for the next sensationalist story. I think the girls really must struggle with that.
But is it not better, it's an interesting question, that whatever the motives may be, is it not better to give voice to these stories than not to have them at all? I mean, in the end, two major publishing houses, I suppose, have run these stories and media will have picked them up. Even if the motives are not the most benign, is it not good? I mean, is it? So, no, I ask this question genuinely without knowing the answer. Is it good for them that their story has been heard at all?
Well, that's I think, what must be the only comfort to them, that that they know that at least they have had a chance to speak out about what is happening back in their own societies and hope that in some way that will make a difference. And that does ultimately justify it. I do just worry about you know, the girls themselves, and the way they're treated, you know, the way a lot of these people are treated almost as commodities sometimes.
And it does always seem to be girls or young women, doesn't it? I mean, we don't have really equivalent memoirs or biographies of the young men who are coming over.
Well, that's another very, very interesting thing. And are we going to see this or aren't we? I mean, are we going to get stories from young male teenagers coming out who again question their own societies, who question the dominance of the patriarchal system, which, you know, both girls to some extent are caught up in and you know, will now escape from and see a different life. So I'm not so sure, frankly, that we're going to see those sorts of stories because, by and large, you know, a lot of the men are really quite happy with things the way they are. They quite want the women to stay in their place.
And also, I suspect there's a degree of whenever there is a refugee movement into Britain, or whenever we take in more refugees, the clarion call goes up, where are the women? Where are the children? There is a suspicion, rightly or wrongly, and very often wrongly, attached to young men who make the journey, often because they're the most, I suspect, capable of making the journey in whatever sense that means. But I don't. Is it true that there would be such a sympathetic hearing to a young man who comes from Syria in the way that there would be for a young woman?
Well, that's true, yes, that obviously the men are physically more able to make the journey. Also, a lot of the time they've been sent ahead in the hope that they can bring the family, you know, that their extended family at a later point. It's a tricky one. It is a difficult one.
Nujeen Mustafa, she's from Syria, so perhaps we should talk a bit about the country that she's left behind. I mean, especially as there are these important talks coming up on Sunday, I think it is. So what do you think might come out of those talks? I mean, can you conceive of a future for Syria, and what might that look like? What might her home look like?
Well, I think whatever happens with these talks, I don't see girls like this going back anytime soon. Yeah. It's just not going to happen. Apart from anything else, we have to remember that most of the people who've left would not actually be welcome back in Syria. And the fact that they've left, Assad is delighted about it. I mean, he talks quite openly about how much better civil society is, you know, how it's, I mean, it's a form of cleansing, really, that's been going on. He's delighted to have everybody who opposes him leave. And a lot of the young men who've left, of course, are people who do not want to serve in his army. They are of draftable age, although he's raised the draftable age now to 45 anyway. So it's a reflection of how weak the army is and how low in manpower he is. So these girls and many other refugees who've left are not going to be able to go back, and they're not going to feel comfortable that they're not going to be persecuted or held up in as rebels in some way. They'll be frightened that they'll be on blacklists. And so there's going to have to be a massive reconciliation process, a massive amnesty. I mean, a real amnesty, not the sort of slightly fake reconciliation things that Assad has been talking about, which is, you know, what anybody else would call starve and surrender. He calls reconciliation.
But that can't happen, that reconciliation. I mean, in some ways, to put it sort of simplistically, he has won, hasn't he? Assad, there are presumably moments when that was in doubt, but he has reasserted his authority. The Russian intervention and his collaboration with Russia has paid off, and he is now in a strong position. And so presumably that truth and reconciliation moment can't take place under Assad, and it's not looking like he's going anywhere soon.
No, he's not going anywhere soon, and as you rightly say, it's difficult to see how this reconciliation process can happen. Throughout the whole of this nearly 6 year long war, everything about Syria has been difficult to predict. And the thing that strikes me, that I mean, I'm a natural optimist, and so I would love to think that there could be a solution and that Syria could be brought back under one big mantle and that everything, could move forward in some way. But it's become so complex with half the countries of the world virtually,
yeah,
you know, playing out their battles on this sort of playground almost of Syria. But there are some little glimpses of things which I think we could cling to. I mean, for example, I mean, I know Trump, his his coming on the scene is generally people worry about it. But I mean, I wonder whether, for example, I mean, this is a very optimistic view, but, you know, the guy is a businessman. The Middle East does deals all the time. Everything functions on deals. If Trump can come in and just see the whole region in terms of deals that can be done, who knows? You know, he could come in, he could build hotels all over Iran. You know, maybe that they're crying out for hotels. They need, you know, they've got a massive shortage of all the tourists, for all the tourists who want to go there now. Huge reconstruction deals could be done, you know, a kind of massive Marshall Plan. If everybody could gain something from all these deals, then there might be a hope.
Or at the very least, he might well say
money talks, you know.
Yeah, and he might well. An Iranian journalist said to me that she wanted Trump to win, not Hillary, because at the very least he looks inward, not outwards, and he's going to be concerned about America, making America great again, etc., etc. He's not got any form of mandate that he gives himself to meddle in Middle Eastern politics or even geopolitics, really, generally, and therefore he's less likely to pour petrol on a fire than, say, even someone well-intentioned like Clinton or Obama would do.
I think that's right.
But let's, I suppose, cling to the glimmer of optimism you offered there, Diane. It's possibly a good way to sort of leave this, that there are remarkable stories like the two that you tell in this review, and there is just the possibility that there is no such thing as an infinite war. In the end, people grow tired and there are opportunities to fix it. Because Syria was not a nation really cursed by sectarianism. It was a nation where people did get on before this civil war started to a greater or lesser extent. So we can say perhaps you might be an optimistic person, but there may be some glimmerings of optimism there as well.
Absolutely. I think, you know, knowing Syrian society as I do quite well, the cohesiveness of it constantly amazes me. And all this sort of sectarian divisions that the Western media likes to go on about are not really that prevalent. You know, they're not. I mean, the Assad regime wants to play on them, wants to create them. But people realize that they're being pushed into traps there, and they're not playing game. Actually, the Syrians I know say we know that we're being forced into sectarian issues here, but we're not interested. We don't care. You know, we know that it's all about trust. And if we trust our neighbors, if we trust the people we work with and relate to on a daily basis, then it doesn't matter whether they're Muslim, Christian, Sunni, Shia, Kurd, whatever.
Diana, thank you so much for doing this piece, and thank you very much for joining us now.
Not at all. It's been a pleasure.
From one piece sensitive to geography to another, Jenny Hendricks has reviewed two books containing and about maps of New York City. You Are Here by Catherine Harmon and Nonstop Metropolis by Rebecca Solnit and Joshua Jelly Shapiro. Taken together, they make the claim that a straightforward Google map might tell you literally where you are, but will not tell you anything about where that is emotionally, spiritually, sociologically, or subjectively. A street is more than just a linear collection of houses. A borough is more than just a collection of streets. They are places of domestic happiness or grief, of work and play, and the remembered backdrops of individual moments in our lives. So maps exist, for example, in these books to show, this is a quote, where the city gets most kinky and where the Manhattan's rich single men are, the places you're most likely to see celebrities, the location of sitcoms, the best sledding hills, and so on. Maps should provide context, that critical piece of furniture in our understanding that makes us have that understanding, I think. And these books set out to celebrate just that. Jenny Hendricks joins us now from New York. Hi, Jenny.
Hi there.
They sound like beautiful books, actually, both of them. But what are the maps that linger with you when you remember them? What are either the funky or the interesting or the emotional aspects of the maps that you recall when you look back on these books?
There's one in Rebecca Solnit's Nonstop Metropolis that I think about a lot, that it's called Harbors and Harpooners, and it's actually a map showing Lower Manhattan and the sites of publishing and sites of whaling during the years of Herman Melville.
Is there a kind of glorious randomness to these books that you might get a map like that next to something else, or is there a linear narrative? Is there a conclusion you're expected to draw when you read them?
Yeah, so there is this kind of playfulness and this kind of broad exploration of these different layers, placing things together that really spark just a kind of not even necessarily a new understanding, but a new approach to a city or to a place more broadly. in addition to that, I think if you're to take some kind of message away from this kind of mapping, it would be that, you know, all maps involve choices, and all of them, you know, none of them are objective. All of them have these subjective characteristics.
And one of these books in particular, I think it's the Harman volume, that sort of goes back to earlier examples of this.
Yes, that one includes quite a few historical maps. So things like insurance maps, older pictures of the city. Yeah, various maps that came out from the 1800s, 1700s, surveys, things like that.
There's one that pictures New York that I'm thinking of, which has this. It's almost like the whole of Manhattan is a cultivated lawn for.
That was one of the earliest ones. So it was from the 17th century, and it kind of imagines, it's just the very tip of Manhattan, because that was the first British colony there, or originally Dutch, but at that time it was British. And it kind of imagines it as these geometrical gardens, very tidy, very beautiful, very cultivated, which of course at that time was not true at all.
I'm interested in what your creative map or creative atlas of New York would look like, Jenny. Do you have a sense of that when you're thinking of it? Do you have a sense of streets where something happens? You talk a little bit about moments where you can think, there's a phone calls received when the Q train rises above ground to cross the Manhattan Bridge, a daily walk. Do you now see New York as part of your own creative atlas? Are there sort of places that occur to you and crystallise in that way?
Yeah, well, I think probably everybody has their own mental atlas of the city and of any place, really. And I think that's part of what's suggested by both of these books. But for myself, yeah, I mean, I, like anyone, I have my routines, and each place you kind of go through becomes marked by things that happen to you, by thoughts you think, by moods you're in, by kind of the imaginative elements that it summons in you.
So I guess both of these books are very much about getting you to, I suppose, question everything. When you walk along a stretch of tarmac, it seems one way to you, but, you know, a drug dealer might walk along that same stretch and it's a completely different space to him. Or, you know, if you go back 60 years before, that's where a particular riot took place. So it's about kind of the strata of the thing.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and when you think about, you're walking along a road and there was once a whole community that was torn down to allow that road to be built. Under Eastern Parkway, there was this middle-class free black community called Carville during Reconstruction. And, you know, and then there's other things like Broadway was built on what was once the Native American path.
I love that detail. I find things like that so fascinating. The idea that Broadway was once a Native American pathway.
And you have things like Wall Street, which is so-called because there was a wall there.
What was the wall?
Around the original colony.
The Brits built a wall and made the Americans pay for it.
That's right.
I believe that's the way these things are. There's a great joke.
Fine precedent.
Yeah, there's a great joke about Trump. America's having a lot of bad luck recently. It must have built something on an old Indian burial ground. Thank you so much for... It's a great piece. Thank you very much for doing it, and thank you so much for joining us now.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. I love those books.
You commissioned this, didn't you?
I did, yes. And it really actually really pained me to have to send out, especially the Rebecca Solnit and Joshua Jelly Shapiro one. It really pained me to have to send that to Jenny, because I can spend hours looking at things like that. As I said, I love this idea of layering on one street. It sort of reminds me of, I don't know quite why, but it sort of reminds me of Seamus Heaney's bog poetry.
Yeah.
This idea of layers waiting to be excavated, and that there is this preserved reality, this connection.
Yeah. I like the idea that it's all maps are distortions, aren't they?
Mm.
And so the size of your country tends to sort of swell because that's where the map was drawn originally. And you see that even in the sort of Mercator projection, it's not a realistic view of
Europe at its centre.
But I like this idea of a creative atlas that, you know, if you were to draw your map of London, there'd be the place where you might have met someone important, or the place where something happened and you lost your wallet, or you did something, and that taken together would actually be a rather interesting and very individualistic version of London for us, or New York, New York for Jenny.
Mm. And some of the ones that Jenny's piece lists, some of the maps that it lists, you know, things like squirrel runs or you know, the way that waste moves in and water moves into the city and then moves out of the city, and how that sort of tips New York off its, because you think of New York as, yes, the centre of the world or of a world, and this,
well, certainly New Yorkers do.
Exactly, New Yorkers do. Well, that Jenny points to that famous New Yorker cover.
Yeah. View from 6th Avenue.
Exactly.
Called. Yeah.
Where everything else just sort of drifts off into an insignificant horizon.
Yeah. It's a lovely piece. It's a really great idea. And, you know, I was a bit dismissive of psychogeography, and I think it can become a bit laboured, but the idea of meaning of place being evoked by either writing or pictures.
And I do think this is different to psychogeography. Yeah. It's more anthropological. It's more sort of social art, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's just really enjoyable and great to get anyone who lives in a place writing about that place and forcing them to look at it differently.
Yeah, and you definitely get that sense from Jenny. That's almost all we have time for this week. Let me thank, on behalf of Thea and me, Jenny Hendricks, Diana Dark and Emma McBride. Please do subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back every week this year with thoughts on the big pieces in the TLS and important cultural and artistic issues. This week's paper is now on sale with the pieces we have been discussing, plus Alexander Murray on the power of palaces, Robert Irwin on the connection between Islam and Arab history, Emily Bickerton on the haunted life of Shirley Jackson, Robert Douglas Fairst on the award-winning La La Land. Have you seen that yet, dear?
I'm desperate to.
Are you going to see it?
Yeah, I think it's out tomorrow. It's out on the 13th or the 12th.
So you're going to watch it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I am not going to watch it. But there we
go. Oh, you're not?
I have musicals. I can't really be bothered.
Well, no, I am not a musical.
But this one you're going to give a go.
Yeah, very interested. And did you see Whiplash?
No.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, it's the same director.
But good.
I liked Whiplash. Okay.
Well, we'll discuss that later. Alice Spall's also on the inspirations of Paul Nash. You can visit our website, the-tls.co.uk, to read it all and learn more about our print and digital subscriptions. And do come back daily to the site for new original pieces from TLS writers, including Rebecca Swirsky on Japan's newest international art festivals and Achdaf Suef, who wishes she had written Anna Karenina.
I'm sure many people do.
She didn't have a go at any Victorian novelists.
Does she like? Sadly. Oh, she likes Dickens. Yeah, yeah. Or just doesn't comment.
She doesn't mention it. We're going to conclude that she does. And you can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and review us on iTunes. And do join us next week, where we hope to be talking about how to reboot Jane
Austen.
It's
not as violent as it sounds.
No, oh, I did watch Pride and Prejudice and Zombies in preparation for it. It wasn't very good.
No. Don't imagine.
There's a shock. The managing editor of the TLS also watched it on the same evening and he enjoyed it.
Well, no one can say that we don't represent a variety.
It's a broad church. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.